Welcome to the second hour's readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
ORMC announces OBGYN Hospitalist Program. As part of its overall commitment to women's health and care for expecting mothers, Odessa Regional Medical Center, ORMC, now offers an OBGYN hospitalist program to provide consistent care to patients in our hospital, as well as emergent care to those arriving in labor and delivery. Staffing Odessa Regional Medical Center with hospital-based OBGYN physicians serves to enhance patient safety and improve the coordination and efficiency of care, said Stacy Brown, president of ORMC. It also provides peace of mind for our patients, since an OBGYN is available at a moment's notice to step in to provide care. ORMC's OBGYN Hospitalist Program brings an experienced team of board-certified obstetricians and gynecologists on-site to ORMC 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Those dedicated OBGYN physicians at ORMC provide a number of services, including providing care in times of emergency prior to the arrival of a patient's own physician, supporting the care of high-risk pregnancy patients, and delivering babies for patients who don't have an obstetrician. The OBGYN hospitalists are required to have additional training in neonatal resuscitation, advanced cardiac life support, and OB emergency care. ORMC's OB hospitalists will also be available for consultations in the hospital and for emergent care in ORMC's main emergency department. Types of urgent care cases the hospitalists might see include patients 16 weeks pregnant or greater who require emergency care, ectopic pregnancies, miscarriages, and tubo-ovarian abscesses. Because OB hospitalists are always on site, they can provide immediate surgery or manage problems until the patient's OBGYN arrives.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading a locally written opinion column from the Odessa American, published Wednesday, April 1st, 2020. Guest View, Act Now to Save the U.S. Oil Industry, by D. Kirk Edwards. Let me start out with a simple analogy. You have a water hose hooked up to your house. We will call your house the Permian Basin. The other end is your garden. We will call that end the Gulf Coast Refining Complex. As we all know, the water flows very well from the hose until the worst thing possible can happen. It gets plugged off. Spoiler alert, we are now within 1 month of that hose being completely plugged off. How and why is this happening? First, we all are experiencing oil dumping that is killing demand by the Saudis and the Russians vis-a-vis with the economic impact of the coronavirus. Demand is being devastated everywhere, and refiners are seeing their gasoline and jet fuel sales devastated. They are forced to slow down the refineries to minimum levels just to keep them running. Refiners are clearly not needing as much oil as they needed a month ago, and won't until the virus passes by our country and we are all getting back to something like normal. One of my friends who operates in the Permian Basin told me today that their oil marketing consultants warned him that the storage situation is becoming dire. Take my hose analogy. Well, along that so-called hose are large storage tanks. These are there for many reasons, but in times of pipeline or demand problems, the pipeline companies can use storage to help add or hold more barrels as the situation requires. My friend was told that the differential for oil in West Texas, called West Texas Intermediate or WTI, is trending from a positive $1 per barrel currently to a negative $10 per barrel in May. This equates to a price per barrel of $20 WTI being effectively reduced to $10 per barrel in May. Some producers might actually be unable to sell their oil at any price due to unavailable storage in Midland, Cushing, Oklahoma, or the Gulf Coast. A second and maybe the more important reason for our pricing woes are the Saudis and Russians getting together and taking advantage of the COVID virus outbreak to flood the world oil markets with excess oil. They may call it a price war, but it is clear and simple a direct attack to once and for all devastate the American energy producer, and to us here in the Permian Basin, they are doing a very good job of it. Now, back to our hose going to the Gulf Coast. Refiners are seeing other hoses materialize, foreign hoses. Those foreign hoses are flowing with crude oil at massive discounts to entice the refiners to buy their oil instead of our good old made in the USA oil. As mentioned in my previous op-ed, why should we support any foreign country that is doing this to us? If now our American refineries are buying foreign crude instead of American crude, just for the sake of profit in these dire COVID virus times, we should at least know who they are. It is simply un-American, in my opinion, and we can all address this problem at the gas pump and the stock market. Reuters is reporting this week that Saudi leased out a record number of 40 supertankers, which hold 80 million barrels of oil, to strategically flood that oil into our U.S. markets at their will, and then also not allow U.S. exporters to utilize them. This caused tanker rates to go from $40,000 per day to $200,000 per day overnight. Is that not premeditated? This is a threat to our own domestic industry. Why can't the Trump administration see this? It is our 2020 version of Pearl Harbor. Will we react appropriately to defend our country this time? We have a solution. Until 2 days ago, I was 100% against the use of pro-ration in Texas to remedy these kinds of problems. Pro-ration is the mandate by our Texas Railroad Commission to only allow Texas oil producers to produce a percentage of their actual full output. This rule was set up in the 1920s when the East Texas field came online and Texas production far outpaced what could be used in those days. This is the same scenario we have today due to the feeble demand from the COVID virus outbreak. Why was I against oil proration back then? Simply put, if our American producers backed off their production, the foreign oil guys would have seen the opening and oversupply the market with their cheap crude oil. But wow, like many of my colleagues, my how my view has changed this past week. Scott Sheffield of Pioneer Natural Resources and Matt Gallagher and Brian Sheffield of Parsley Energy have recently been making the pitch for the Texas Railroad Commission to look at pro-ration again for Texas producers. That is what the commission has done for many such events over the last 100 years. But the commission is hesitant because of politics and because many feel it's a good thing in the long run to let foreign oil take Texas's oil's place. This is where the Trump administration and the Department of Energy needs to step in. They should immediately place a tariff on imported oil coming into this country and expose any U.S.-owned refinery that is taking imported oil into its refinery at the expense of American oil. By placing these tariffs and the Texas Railroad Commission implementing a sensible pro-ration strategy until this COVID virus passes, it will save our American domestic energy industry. The industry would not want this, nor should it be permanent. Free enterprise should and will take over again. But as President Trump has stated emphatically this week, we are at war. We need our president and our elected Texas Railroad Commissioners to step up to the plate and save Texas and the American energy industry right now before it is too late. We need to send a message to Saudi Arabia and Russia that America will not stand for their deliberate dumping of oil here any longer. Our country is in economic crisis. Our own proverbial water hose can help quench the thirst of our great nation. Will you help us now? D. Kirk Edwards is an Odessa-based independent oil and gas producer.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, April 1st, 2020. This is the opinion section. This column is entitled Guest View and comes from the San Antonio Express News. It is entitled Selena's Presence Endures 25 Years After Her Death. She's been gone longer than she was here. But in the 25 years since Selena Quintanilla's death at the age of 23, her presence as a cultural and music icon endures. For those unaware of her phenomenon, her significance, and how deeply she was loved among Tejano music fans and the Mexican-American community, it became quickly evident on March 31, 1995, that this was more than the premature passing of a popular entertainer. Hours after the Grammy Award-winning singer was shot in Corpus Christi by the president of her fan club, Selena's music was flowing from vehicles backed up on Broadway and Mulberry Street as people headed to a candlelight vigil at Sunken Garden Theater. Her boutique, a few blocks away on Broadway, immediately bloomed into a memorial of flowers, photos, and messages. The outpouring of emotion in scenes like this was repeated across the country for weeks. In death, Selena became a revelation to people who'd never heard of her or Tejano music and knew little, if anything, about the Mexican-American community. She made many Americans aware of the rich veins of culture throughout the country with which they were unfamiliar. Celebrated San Antonio singer Erika Gonzaba has been singing Selena's songs since she was 10. Selena's music has transcended time. She's legendary, Gonzaba said. The impact she's had on generations of people, especially in the Latin community, is incomparable. She will always be an inspiration and an icon to so many people all over the world. The unexpected death of a young artist or athlete inevitably leads to years of speculating what might have been. This is no less true of Selena. While we'll never know how far her extraordinary gifts as a singer, dancer, and performer would have carried her, we have an idea. Her death came months before the release of the album Dreaming, she hoped would bring her crossover success. It did, posthumously. There's no reason to doubt, given the arc of her career, her talent, and the album's quality, that she would have achieved crossover success and soared to even greater heights had her life not been taken. A tribute concert Selena's family had planned for the Alamo Dome has been rescheduled because of the coronavirus. That concert and next year's celebration of what will be her 50th birthday will be times for fans to gather to remember what was and to dream about what could have been.
Hi, this is Linda, Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, April 1st, 2020, Section B, Health and Wellness. Museum of the Southwest uses 3D printers to make ventilator valves, by J.C. Lewis. The Museum of the Southwest has started 3D printing ventilator valves to assist during the coronavirus crisis. The museum's executive director, Dan Eck, asked board member Dr. Summer Merritt how the museum could help. I was emailing with Dr. Summer Merritt. She was on the museum board of trustees, and we have been emailing and catching up and talking about these 3D printed adapters that you can make for ventilators that were in the news, Eck said. He said Merritt found an open source file on the internet to print a ventilator valve. The typical ventilator is designed to work with one person, and it pushes oxygen out at a certain rate, he said. It has one connector going through the tubes that go to the patient. And what they've been experimenting with around the world is a simple piece of plastic that will take a ventilator and branch it off from one outlet into as many as four outlets. He said that ventilators have the capacity to support more than one patient at a time. Ventilators are designed with an excess of capacity, so they can work with more than one human, but they've just never had to be put through the paces like this, except in rare emergencies, X said. During the mass shooting a few years ago in Las Vegas, doctors jerry-rigged some of the ventilators to work like this, he said. The concept is, if we can 3D print some of these very simple adapters, it's almost like a vacuum cleaner adapter piece. It takes from one valve and it branches out to four valves, X said. They could get maybe two, three, maybe even up to four people on one ventilator at a time. The H connector for ventilators is an open source collaboration between Copper 3D and Jorge M. Zuniga with the University of Nebraska at Omaha, Department of Biomechanics. There is no substitute for staying home, staying out of groups of any size, and stopping or reducing the spread of the virus, X said. That has to be the issue number one for this community right now. The Museum of the Southwest has two 3D printers, but more are needed. At the request of Dr. Merritt and Jack Ladd, who's our councilman for our area, we're trying to chase down people who have 3D printers and share the file with them, because it takes anywhere from 8 to 10 hours to print one of these. The museum has contacted other facilities that have 3D printers. University of Texas Permian Basin, Ellen Knoll Art Museum, the Midland County Public Library, Midland Academy Charter School, and Midland College. Pretty much anybody who's got a 3D printer and a supply of plastic can take this file that we have and start replicating this, he said. X said the museum's goal is to make 40 valves for Midland Memorial Hospital. Our theory is, why not spend a few bucks on plastic and have these things on hand just in case, X said. There's not a magic bullet, but there's no harm in having them on hand. He said Blakemore Planetarium Director Valerie Rodriguez modified the file Friday to support the valve while it's being printed, because the valve can be broken off after printing. The first valve was printed at the planetarium. X said he also has reached out to Odessa Regional Medical Center and Medical Center Health Systems. The original specs call for a certain proprietary type of plastic that's antimicrobial, he said. It's a special type of medical grade plastic. None of us here have that, so we're just going to go with our standard rosin plastics we have. He said there is an initiative on Facebook and Instagram called Protect Our Frontline West Texas. It's put together by a group of area doctors who have been strategizing on how best to serve the community, he said. As a museum, we love Midland, and we're supporting that initiative. We've got some incredibly smart doctors and medical professionals here in town, and we need to listen to them and let them lead us through this. FDA says hand sanitizer has expiration date, by Mark Price of the Charlotte Observer. The Food and Drug Administration just pointed out something about bottles of hand sanitizer people are hoarding during the coronavirus pandemic. They have an expiration date. It's likely few noticed the fine print while grabbing handfuls off shelves in recent weeks. It's hard enough just to find a bottle lately. Should we worry, given 86,000 Americans have been infected with COVID-19? The FDA has good and bad news. Good news: adding some kind of expiration date is a standard on all over-the-counter drug products unless they have data showing they are stable for more than 3 years, the agency said Thursday. Bad news. FDA does not have information on the stability or effectiveness of drug products past their expiration date. So, if the expiration date on your hand sanitizer is pre-2017, you're gambling on effectiveness. The chief concern, according to Healthline.com, is that alcohol is a key ingredient of hand sanitizer and it evaporates when exposed to air. If the bottle is not airtight, the percentage of alcohol diminishes. The manufacturer estimates how long it will take for the percentage of the active ingredient to drop below 90% of the percentage stated on the label, Healthline.com says. That time estimate becomes the expiration date. The FDA is not offering advice on what to do with expired sanitizer, but emergency measures implemented to speed up production suggest the agency is willing to ignore expiration dates for the time being. Hand sanitizer produced under the temporary policies for hand sanitizer production and compounding may not have an expiration date listed because they are expected to be used during this public health emergency, the agency says. Washing hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds is one way to stop the spread of the virus, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. If soap and water are not available, CDC recommends consumers use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol, the agency reports. Meanwhile, FDA recommends that consumers do not make their own hand sanitizer. If made incorrectly, hand sanitizer can be ineffective, and there have been reports of skin burns from homemade hand sanitizer. Doctors say don't hesitate to seek help for other emergencies. From the American Heart Association. With hospitals across America focused on people who have developed COVID-19, some people with unrelated but still urgent health problems are feeling awkward about reporting to emergency rooms. They shouldn't, doctors say. It's true the coronavirus is stressing the healthcare system. Hospitals have canceled or postponed elective surgeries and taken other steps to make sure they can handle patients who develop severe cases of COVID-19. Everyone, doctors say, can help ease the strain by finding alternate ways to handle routine requests. But people with serious symptoms shouldn't ignore them, said Dr. Sarah Perman, Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine in Denver. Emergency workers know what to do, she said, even when things seem chaotic. Departments are making plans behind the scenes to ensure adequate staffing and keep patients and workers safe amid a surge. This is kind of our forte, she said. We're all trained in disaster. As she's worked the ER in recent days, she's heard people with urgent needs apologize for coming in. They say, "Wow, I know you're really busy," and think they probably shouldn't have sought help. That's a mistake, she said. In fact, her advice on who needs emergency care now isn't incredibly different from what I might have suggested a month ago. Clearly, red flag symptoms like chest pain, acute onset of shortness of breath, acute weakness in an arm or leg, those sorts of things required emergency care in the past, and they require emergency care now. That doesn't mean people shouldn't adapt to the fast-changing situation, which could vary from community to community.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, March 31st, 2020. The education section. Teaching has changed since spring break, by Amber Kelly from Howard College. Any teacher can tell you that the class before vacation is a struggle. The students are antsy with the smell of freedom, and you are hesitant to introduce any new information that will be forgotten in the days before you see them again. College students are no different. The last class I taught before spring break was a lesson on wordiness, an activity that ends with students revising convoluted sentences. It wasn't a serious day. Rather, we laughed together, learned a little, and went our separate ways, assuming we would see each other again in 12 days. Of course, that isn't how it played out. When we did see each other again, it would be 19 days later from different parts of the country. For me, this transition to online content instruction was not too daunting. I have taught online for years and have taken online courses. Beyond that, the challenge now facing the educators at all levels is part of the community college status quo. No money, training, resources, or time. Fix the problem. Even before this, community college instructors have had to MacGyver Apollo 13, or whatever you want to call it, taking almost nothing and making it into something meaningful. In the weeks since social distancing, I have seen a rise in think pieces on distance education. Maybe, some experts pose it, this is the beginning of the future. This is showing us that learning can be done at a distance. Perhaps the world of face-to-face classes should be left in the past. Even before the novel coronavirus drove us into our homes, the extinction of traditional classes has been an educational what-if with many, including some of my own campus, declaring that brick and mortar was short-lived. There are times when I have believed this myself. Yet, as I sat in my workout room with my headset on, Zooming with my students, I questioned if distance learning will truly be the new normal after we can reopen the schools. Since announcing that we would go online, I had received panicked messages from my face-to-face students, frustrated and terrified of moving into the new medium. I was pleasantly surprised that most wanted to take me up on my offer to Zoom our classes each week. Then I was delighted to see their faces at the other end of the computer. During those first classes, several asked if there was any possibility we could return to campus. We laughed over silly things, shared Netflix suggestions, and yes, even had class. It was simultaneously weird and normal. Some of my students even requested that we meet again later in the week. I told them that as long as I had students who wanted to learn in our strange new space, I would teach. I'm sure in the coming weeks the attending students will taper off. Fewer will show up, and more will just fast forward through the recordings posted after class. It will become our new normal without us realizing it. However, I believe this new order will be short-lived following this health crisis. Like so many aspects of our current situation, we will treasure our opportunities to connect in real life once again. I already miss the little moments of being in the same space with my students or waving to them as we cross campus. That personal connection is much of what I love about being a community college professor. It is also something many students seek when selecting a community college as their first higher education step. I doubt we will bid farewell once this is all over. Technology will return to being a tool, not our only option. In the meantime, it is important for teachers to keep in touch with our students and find new ways to connect with them, if for nothing else, then to provide them with a lifeline to their education. My 9-year-old son, who is not the biggest fan of school, has delighted in his meetings with his class and dyslexia teacher. As parents, we should encourage our children to take advantage of these interactions and attempt, as best we can, to keep them on some sort of schedule, but don't feel like you must occupy every moment of their day with learning activities. I won't pretend we have a magnificent color-coded chart. We also may have had cookies for breakfast one day last week. Despite that, I have seen my kids and students find reprieve in the structure of schoolwork. Finally, for all the students out there of any age, know your teachers miss you and are still championing for your success. We're just a little further away. Amber Kelly is an associate professor at Howard College and a doctoral candidate at Texas Tech University. Professors make online classes easier. Editor's note: Jenna Kelly is enrolled in Amber Kelly's Composition 1 course. The Howard College English Department selected her column from student submissions for publication in the Reporter-Telegram. Any form of school can be challenging, especially during a global pandemic. As most people have heard, there is a disease, coronavirus, spreading all throughout the world. This pandemic has caused most schools in the United States to shut down, including Howard College. I am a biology major at Howard College in Big Spring. I reside in Andrews with my family, but during the school semesters, I live in the dorm. During this pandemic, however, I have had to move out of the dorm and back home. All of my classes have switched to online. On top of that, my brother is a senior in high school. His school has also shut down and moved to teaching classes remotely. This has been a real challenge because, just like many other college or high school students, I have never taken an online class. I learn best from face-to-face or hands-on classes. While this has been a huge change for me and many other students, I think most of us can say that the staff at Howard College has attempted to make this easier for us. Two of my professors have set up times for the class to video chat and speak about the assignments and stuff going on during the week. This has been very helpful. Without professors such as Greg Gabehart, my history professor, and Amber Kelly, my English professor, I would almost certainly be a whole lot more panicked about my online classes. Mrs. Kelly and Mr. Gephardt have released tons of information on how we are proceeding as a class, which is such a relief. They have even gone so far as to ask us students how we are adjusting to the online class and letting us know that if we have any concerns, to go ahead and email them. With teachers like these, I believe the education system will most definitely survive having to shut down and teach classes remotely. Through these awful circumstances, I believe that many others, myself included, have a newfound respect for education workers. Before this pandemic, most students and parents did not understand teaching and the work that comes with it. We often believed that teaching was really them lecturing and grading papers. But it is so much more than that. With teaching, they not only have to prepare lessons, but make sure that each student understands the content. They also must be a source of support for the students and a leader. I personally don't believe I would be able to do this job the way it needs to be done, especially not during these circumstances. Throughout these circumstances, I have learned a lot more about what it is to be a teacher. They have very difficult jobs. Yet, I never hear them complain about what they do. It is such a vital job. Without them, we wouldn't have people like Albert Einstein or Steve Jobs. Despite all the hard times in our country has been through, teachers continue to do their jobs to the absolute best that they can. For this, I have an immense respect for teachers and all that they do for us students and the country. This pandemic is very frightening for everybody, but there are still people who are passionate about their work and who continue to work throughout this frightening time. I am the kind of person who panics in times like these. So I think it is so amazing that we have school systems that are capable of relieving some of that panic. I deeply appreciate everything that the school systems here in West Texas have done for its students. And I am so very blessed to be able to continue to receive an education. I am a firm believer that education is a much-needed resource. Without a good education, we could be limited in our abilities, whether that's the ability to get a good job or the ability to earn enough money to live on. Either way, education is and should be a huge part of our society and community. In conclusion, I want to sincerely thank each education worker for everything that they do or have done for our communities. These workers have helped most every student remain calm during these times, including me. So, for that, I applaud them. I know many parents are probably freaking out over the pandemic and what is it has forced our schools to do. But just know that our education system will survive and continue to thrive as well, because all of the amazing education workers who are passionate about teaching your children. Remember to thank your children's teachers occasionally. I guarantee that they don't hear that a lot and will greatly appreciate your noticing the hard work that they do. Jenna Kelly was born in Dallas and graduated from high school in Minot, North Dakota. She is a biology major at Howard College. MISD is serving meals to students. Midland ISD Child Nutrition Services, CNS, will provide free breakfast and lunch to students who want them. Students do not have to be on free or reduced lunch to receive a meal. Meals are grab and go and may be picked up at any of the locations. Also, academic enrichment packets may be picked up at the meal sites. More information is available at www.midlandisd.net/COVID-19. Breakfast will be served 7:30 to 8:30 a.m. and lunch will be 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m.
This is the obituary column, Wednesday, April 1st, 2020. Glenda Jean Evans of Midland, Texas, passed away peacefully on March 29th, 2020 in Midland. Jean was born June 15, 1934 in Waco, Texas, to Evelyn Spires Talley and William Frank Talley. Jean is preceded in death by her husband of 64 years, Jimmy Ray Evans, and her youngest daughter, Lisa Gail George. She is survived by her daughter, Vicki Lynn Beggs, and husband, Steve, son-in-law, Joe Don George, two sisters, Faye Bolton and Janice Scott, and one brother, Jimmy Talley, six grandchildren, nine great-grandchildren, and many nieces and nephews. The family will have a private interment at Rest Haven Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, please give to any charitable organization of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Condolences may be sent at www.npwelsh.com. Lois May Lettinen. Lois May Lettinen, Chelsea, MI, formerly of Midland, Texas, age 77, died Friday, March 27, 2020. Her family sang Blessed Assurance and prayed her into the presence of Jesus. She was born January 4, 1943, in Antigo, Wisconsin, the daughter of Frank and Lenore Emmerich Charles. Survivors include three children, Linda Emmanuel Rafla of Louisville, Kentucky, Laura Brian Sales of Midland, Texas, Larry Don Lyons of Chelsea, Michigan, 10 grandchildren, Andrew, Rebecca, and Matthew Rafla, Joshua Sales, Andrew Sales, Kimberly Hartman and Joseph Sales, Laura, Sean, and Tim Lyons, 8 great-grandchildren, a brother, David, Linda Charles of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a sister, Gail Lemno of Antigo, Wisconsin, as well as extended family, and many friends. She was preceded in death by her husband, Jeff Lehtinen, in 1985. Her parents, a sister, Jean Ann DeBoat, who died a month ago, and two brothers-in-law, Jerry Demlow and John DeBoat. Burial will be with her beloved husband, Jeff, at Forest Hill Cemetery in Aurora, Minnesota. Memorial contributions may be made to the Salvation Army of Midland, 600 East Wall Street, Midland, Texas, 79701, in honor of Lois Lehtinen. Arrangements were entrusted to Cole Funeral Chapel in Chelsea. Juanice Blackholler, 97, passed away on March 28, 2020, in Longview, Texas. Juanice was born December 14, 1922, in Newsom, Texas, to Sam Austin Johnson and Laura Harris Johnson. She was preceded in death by her daughter, Barry Blackholler, in 1973, her husband, Edward H. Blackholler, in 1993, and her daughter, Kathy Blackholler, in 2004. She is survived by her son, Gary Blackholler of Longview, grandson, Sam Blackholler, and wife, Carolyn of Midland, granddaughter, Sarah Hippolito, and husband, Andrew, and their children, Caden and Luna of Austin, and grandson, Bradley Blackholler, and wife, Jackie, and their daughter, Juliana of Austin. Due to current public health concerns, a celebration of life memorial service will be held at a later date. The family suggests memorials be made to the West Texas Food Bank. Death notices. Daisy Elizabeth La Rosa Espinosa. Daisy Elizabeth La Rosa Espinosa, 69, of Miami, Florida, passed away on March 30, 2020, in Midland, Texas. Daisy was born on July 8, 1950, to Elda Espinosa and Juan La Rosa in Caracas, Venezuela. No services are scheduled at this time. Arrangements by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home and Crematory. Fay Baum, 80, of Midland, passed away Sunday, March 29, 2020. No services will be held at this time. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Jacqueline Marie Elwell passed away on March 29, 2020 in Houston, Texas. A viewing will be held on Tuesday, March 31st from 3 to 5 p.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home in Midland. A graveside service will be held on Wednesday, April 1st at 4 p.m. at American Heritage Cemetery in Midland. Jimmy Braswell is officiating. Arrangements by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home and Crematory.
Death notices for Wednesday, April 1st. Terry Lee Dunlap. Terry Lee Dunlap, 65, of Odessa, died Monday, March 30th. Celebration of life is scheduled from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, April 2nd, at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Jacqueline Marie Wilson Elwell. Jacqueline Marie Wilson Elwell, 54, of Needville, died Sunday, March 29th, in Houston. Graveside service was held April 1st at American Heritage Cemetery, with Jimmy Braswell officiating. Blanca Silvia Calderon Alvarado. Blanca Silvia Calderon Alvarado, 59, of Pecos, died Saturday, March 28th. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Daisy Elizabeth La Rosa Espinosa. Daisy Elizabeth La Rosa Espinosa, 69, of Miami, died Monday, March 30th in Midland. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland.
This is the medical advice column to your good health by Dr. Keith Roach. Small painful boils in head. Dear Dr. Roach, could you tell me what causes small boils all over the head? They are very painful. Answer. Skin infections are caused most commonly by Streptococcus, strep, and Staphylococcus, staph species. As a general rule, if it has pus, it's staph. If not, it's strep. These organisms live on the skin and can cause infection where there are breaks in the skin. Even microscopic breaks allow the bacteria to enter. When there are many areas of infection on the scalp, the concern is that the hair follicles are the location of the infection. A clinical exam can confirm this. Sometimes the follicles get damaged by something you're doing. Frequent scratching or pulling on hair, tight hairstyles, and some hair care products can predispose to developing folliculitis of the scalp. Some scalp conditions, such as eczema, can predispose to scalp infections. A dermatologist would have the most expertise in looking for underlying hair or scalp conditions. Local treatment, including warm compresses, anti-dandruff shampoo, or antibiotic creams, may resolve the problem. However, oral antibiotics are sometimes necessary.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, March 31st, 2020, etc. page. Revenge is delivered on wedding day. Dear Abby, this is an open letter to all those women who write to you knowing their men cheated on them and then ask, should I marry him? In their hearts, they already know the answer. They just want you to tell them no. My mother saw my fiancé's car around town, parked at various churches and parking lots. He parked there so I wouldn't see his car at the other woman's house. Well, I showed up unexpectedly at his place one night and saw them both asleep in his bed. In a way, I felt relieved. I knew I had to do something. I immediately canceled everything, but had the wedding invitations printed and gave them to his mom and sister to send out right away. When the big day arrived, I sat across the street in Dad's car with my mom, watching as only his side of the family showed up at the vacant church. The note on the door read, "Stay with Jasmine. You two deserve each other. Now tell your family what you did." I explained everything to my parents an hour later over dinner at the restaurant where we were supposed to have had our reception. We were all relieved the wedding was canceled. We laughed so much, and we reviewed all the signs that my mom tried to show me that I had ignored. So don't get mad, ladies. Do what I did. Dry your tears and get even. Never looked back. Dear never. Love is blind, and you should have listened to your mother. You're lucky you found out in time and didn't marry your faithless fiancé. While I don't normally recommend revenge, I think in this case the man had it coming. Dear Abby, I am 52 years old and have experienced chronic fatigue from Lyme and Epstein-Barr most of my adult life. 4 years ago, I discovered a wonderful medical practitioner and, by adhering to her protocol, regained such improved health that I began volunteering with a local organization. Due to a recent setback, however, fatigue has prevented me from volunteering and my absence has been noticed. Although I am usually a private person, I decided to divulge my health issues to the leader so he wouldn't think I was unhappy with my duties. He then began asking if I had tried various health products and remedies to the point where I felt I was on trial and defending myself. In the past, before I received an accurate diagnosis, some family members and physicians doubted the validity of my illness, so I am sensitive to being questioned. Over the years, I have sought treatment from various sources, from local health stores to nationally recognized hospitals, and I don't appreciate advice from healthy armchair experts. I also don't like being questioned or doubted. Did I set myself up by disclosing my health issues, or should I have remained polite but vague? Survivor in the East. Dear survivor, in a sense, yes, you did set yourself up by disclosing the reason for your absence. The medical conditions from which you suffer were poorly understood years ago, and many people, medical personnel included, were under the impression that their patients' problems were all in their heads. Please try to be less defensive where this person is concerned. From my perspective, he was only trying to be helpful. Dear Abby, Abigail Van Buren, write Dear Abby at P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069, or visit www.dearabby.com.
Dear Abby, long absent dad chooses friend over his own family. Dear Abby, my father has been mostly absent from my life. We reconnected when I was an adult. I have always had feelings of abandonment, and because of this, I have constantly tried to build a relationship with him and allow him to have one with his grandchildren. Dad met my friend of 10 years, Danielle, 2 months ago when I threw him a birthday party. Since then, he and Danielle have begun a relationship on the sly. The problem is, Danielle tells Dad things I confided to her over the years, and he is coming back to me with whatever she has told him. Dad has been separated for 14 years, and Danielle insisted that she wouldn't date him under those circumstances, but she did. Since the start of this, my relationship with my dad is even worse, and my long friendship with Danielle has been ruined because I know I can't trust her. Dad spends all of his time with her and her child now, and hasn't begun to build a bond with me or his own grandchildren, which has been the story of my life, and my friend knows this. Abby, am I being selfish? What do you think I should do? More than awkward in Arkansas. Dear Moore, I don't think you are selfish. You have good reason to be hurt and disappointed. Your father is remaining true to character, but your friend has betrayed your trust. You may need the help of a licensed therapist to move beyond this, and that is what I recommend you do. Believe me, you have my sympathy, but you can't change your father or Danielle. You can, however, change the way you react to them, and a therapist will help you do that more quickly than you can do it on your own. Dear readers, on April 1st, I like to share a few of the more offbeat letters I receive. Here are three. Dear Abby, for more than 50 years, my wife has had a close relationship with a stuffed panda bear she received when she was 8 years old. His name is Daffy, and he sits by our fireplace and pretty much rules the house. She makes him talk and takes him places. When I make a mistake, like not hanging up my jacket, I say that Daffy told me not to do it. She gets mad, and I get a lecture from Daffy about how he isn't to blame, and he never makes a mistake. I am joking when I blame Daffy, but my wife and Daffy don't find it funny. Am I wrong to make a joke, or should I not blame Daffy? Daffy told me to write this letter. Pandemonium out west. Dear Pandemonium, it appears there are not one but three Daffys in your household. If you can't bear what's going on, stop joking. P.S. You must think I'm Daffy to believe this letter is legit. Dear Abby, how do you address a letter to three doctors who are in a domestic partnership? Two are married to each other and have the same last name. I addressed it as Doctors Jane and John Doe and Joe Brown, but I wanted to be sure for future correspondence. Three's Company in Atlanta. Dear TC, surrounded by so many doctors, you must be receiving excellent health care. The correspondence should be addressed to Doctors Jane and John Doe and Joe Brown, MD. Joe earned his degree and deserves that title, even if he is coming in third.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or your favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.